Our guests on today's Please Explain segment are two of the authors of The Handbook of Poisonous and Injurious Plants. Yes, just in time for that hike in the woods, our topic is the nasty plants you may come in contact with along the way. Dr. Michael J. Balick is the Vice President for Botanical Science and Director of Phylicology, Curator at the New York Botanical Garden Institute of Economic Botany. He has been studying the relationship between plants and people, the field known as ethnobotany, for over three decades. Dr. Lewis Nelson is an associate professor of emergency medicine at New York University School of Medicine and is an attending physician at both NYU Medical Center and Bellevue Hospital. He's an editor of Goldfrank's Toxicologic Emergencies, now in its ninth edition, a major textbook in the field of medical toxicology. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Dr. Nelson, when we talk about poison ivy, poison oak, or poison sumac, should we even be using the word poison? Because if we touch them, they don't kill us.
Well, I think you've touched upon a real problem with the word poison. I mean, I think we all recognize something as poisonous when we think about it, but you know, the actual definition of poisoning is much more difficult to define. I mean, I guess it's anything that causes some harm to an organism, but that harm could be anything from a rash, like you've talked about poison ivy, to death.
Mm-hmm. But in the case of poison ivy, should we be calling it irritating ivy?
Well, you know, it's not just an irritant, because in fact there's a chemical in poison ivy that interacts with your body to allow your body to generate an immune response to it. So in a way, it's not just something that irritates you, as if I rubbed you, you know, with something that was irritating. It actually has got a chemical basis.
Dr. Balick, why do plants make poisons? Is it mainly defensive, to protect themselves from being eaten?
Well, plants make chemical compounds, including some that are poisonous, for many purposes. First of all, we understand that plants can't run away from the pests that attack them. So through evolutionary time, the plants have developed nasty compounds. The ones that have developed these have been successful. It's a form of chemical warfare. Plants even develop compounds to destroy other plants that might grow near them and compete for water or other resources. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but it's hard to grow things like hydrangea under a black walnut tree. The black walnut tree produces a harmless compound called hydrojuglone, but when that's exposed to air or the soil, it's converted to a toxic compound, juglone, that kills other plants trying to colonize the walnut's territory. So this is sort of how it works. But chemicals can actually change over time. Green tomatoes have a compound in their seeds that discourages predators. But when the tomatoes ripen, as you know, this compound disappears, flavor develops, and the plant has developed a mechanism to entice animals and us to distribute it.
Well, why would the chemicals in poison ivy have been developed by the plant? Obviously, this happened long before humans came along. You want to answer? Either of you. I don't care.
I'm not sure there is an answer, except perhaps as a defense mechanism against animals and other foragers. I mean, they want to live as long as they can as well. I mean, maybe Michael has another answer.
Do they affect all animals? If my cat brushed up against poison ivy or poison oak, would it also develop a rash?
You know, I don't actually know the answer to that question. In general, you know, there are certain things that occur in kind of a broad spectrum across all the animals. The immune systems are quite different. So I would probably imagine that it would be very reasonable to think this wouldn't occur in all animals across the whole kingdom. The animals like cats, in fact, have a protective layer of fur, and other things would prevent the chemical from getting down to the skin anyway. But, you know, poison ivy happens to be, in humans, one of the most potent sensitizers, meaning one of the things that in almost everybody who's exposed to it, it elicits that immune response. There's few people who are exposed to poison ivy who won't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know how that translates to animals per se, but certainly in people it's a very, very potent toxin.
Are poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac the plants we're most likely to come into contact with in our area?
Well, it depends what you're doing. Certainly, if you're, you know, in an area of nature, they're highly likely, and particularly because you're more likely to rub against them than, say, a plant that you'd have to eat in order to be poisoned by it. Poison ivy is everywhere. I mean, it's in your backyard. It's a weed. It grows pretty uncontrollably, and it's so exposure to it. You know, as we become more outdoors, focused, it's becoming more prevalent.
Does it have any function? Most plants seem to be doing something else. All poison ivy seems to be doing is acting as an irritant.
I don't know. I'll let Michael handle that one. I imagine that there's got to be some role that it thinks it has.
Well, we have over 400,000 species of vascular plants on Earth, and I don't know that we know the so-called function from our perspective, but they're all part of our biodiversity.
Mm. And in this case, these plants develop all sorts of complicated chemical mechanisms. Poisoning by plants can be with anti-colloid. Now, you're going to have to forgive me. These plants are a lot more sophisticated chemically than I am. Anticholinergic poisons?
Anticholinergic is the right word.
Calcium oxalate crystals? Cardioactive steroids?
Yeah, we like to make up complicated terms. but they really have medical and chemical meaning. I mean, basically, there are hundreds probably of different mechanisms by which plants can poison. We've kind of distilled them down into categories that we could use medically or clinically to help us figure out what it is that somebody's been exposed to. So, you know, there may be 50 different anticholinergic poisons out there that you'll find in plants, but all of them in your body produce a very similar syndrome, or we call toxicologic syndrome, or even sometimes toxidrome, which when you show up in the emergency department or somewhere seeking help, we can look at you, and based on the findings in your pupil and your skin and your bowel functions and your mental status and a few other things, without any real laboratory tests, perhaps except to rule out other diseases, we can make a diagnosis of poisoning by an anticholinergic plant.
But would you know whether it was poison ivy, poison oak, or poison sumac?
Well, right. I mean, poison ivy and that genre of plants don't produce an anticholinergic toxidrome. This would be much more typical of a plant like Jimson weed,
mm-hmm.
You know, a Deterrus tremonium, which is another plant that grows fairly wildly and prevalently around the United States.
And is much more toxic.
Well, it's a different kind of toxicity, and that's the complication. So the toxicity of poison ivy really is limited, for the most part, to the skin. I mean, if you did burn poison ivy and inhale it, which does happen, it would be devastating to your pulmonary system, and you can really die from it. But for the most part, people who are exposed to poison ivy rub against it. It's got very brittle skin, so to speak, and it deposits its toxin on you. Whereas an anticholinergic plant, you'd have to put into your body. If I think in general, touching up against it would really not produce any symptoms. So people that use Jimson weed go out and find the seeds and brew it, or smoke it, or eat it, or do something with it.
We're talking to two of the authors of the Handbook to Poisonous and Injurious Plants, Doctors Lewis Nelson and Michael J. Ballack. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a little while, we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Dr. Ballack, of all the millions of plants in the world, what percentage are poisonous or dangerous to humans and animals?
Well, we don't know that. We know, as I mentioned, that there are over 400,000 species of fire plants, many more species of fungi. There are tens of thousands known to be used by traditional cultures for medicinal value. There is no accurate list of everything that's poisonous. I think an important lesson here, an important point, is that something can be a medicine, but at a higher dose be a food, or something that can be a very innocuous and at a higher dose be a poison. So it would be very difficult to come up with a extremely accurate list of what percent of those 400,000 are toxic.
You've been studying plant diversity and how local people use plants for medicine, food, construction, and other purposes in some small Micronesian islands. And you've been seeing that kind of overlap?
Yes. yes, certainly, particularly with foods as medicines. And to some degree, poisons as medicines. There's a small legume in the pea family over there that's used as a fish poison. You go to a stream and you drop a little ball of the roots in the stream, and the fish become stunned. They rise to the surface. In earlier times, people would harvest the fish, and then the ones that were not ready for harvest would eventually recover and swim away. This kind of fish poison fishing is no longer practiced or even legal today. But the same plant is used as a medicine for skin irritations in a much more gentle dosage.
And humans have dipped spears in poisons as weapons. So we've been interacting with poisonous plants for a long time, seeing them as in both negative and potentially positive ways.
Yes, one of the most famous arrow poisons, which I assume you're alluding to, is curare from the Amazon. This was eventually developed into a drug called tubocurarine hydrochloride in the 1940s after scientists discovered the indigenous people were using this to paint on their arrows and blowgun darts. Medicine began to use it as a skeletal muscle relaxant given prior to anesthesia and surgery, which made surgery easier. This particular compound isn't used today, however, it's been replaced.
What kinds of characteristics can signal that a plant might be dangerous? Are there certain rules to follow? For example, should we always avoid small, hard red berries or plants with glossy leaves?
I think an important point for your listeners is that there really aren't general rules for avoiding plant toxins and fungi, except to avoid consuming something that's not known to be an edible species. For example, some people think all white berries are poisonous, but that's not the case. So our advice is really to be informed or keep things out of your mouth, which is why we wrote the book. And, for example, if you have small children, practice what I call defensive foraging, and that is avoid putting the children out to pasture in your backyard unsupervised.
And even if it looks like blackberries, it might not be. And
right.
Tell them to not eat it. Dr. Nelson, what kinds of treatments are used in each of the cases that we've been discussing? What should you do or not do when you think you've had contact with poison ivy or poison oak or poison sumac or something of one of the other poisonous plants?
Well, it very much depends on what it is you've been exposed to and how much and what symptoms you have. Poison ivy, as a very easy treatment or as a very easy preventive measure from getting the rash, is wash. You know, soap and water very effectively will take off the resin that is released from the plant onto your skin. If you wash it off within a short period of time, you probably won't get a rash unless you're very, very highly sensitized to the toxin that's in there. But, you know, for other things, if you eat one of the toxins and, you know, it's causing symptoms, you probably need to show up in an emergency department or at least call the poison center or a medical professional and really figure out if you need to be seen by a doctor. Some of these toxins are very quick acting and require very specific therapy. Some of them require more general therapy, such as a decontamination procedure, maybe some activated charcoal by mouth to bind up the toxin in the GI tract or something along those lines. So it's a really complicated answer because there's so many different toxins, literally hundreds of different types of toxins, that each of which might have a slightly different symptom cluster and treatment.
I mentioned earlier that your co-authors, I should have mentioned, along with Dr. Richard Shee, of the Handbook of Poisonous and Injurious Plants, which is published by the New York Botanical Garden in Springer. And one of the interesting things about this is that it brings together the experiences of a botanist and a physician. Do people work in tandem in dealing with some of these plants?
Well, we do in some ways. I mean, we've kind of co-consulted on many poisonings. You know, I really am, you know, barely scratched the surface as an expert in recognizing plants and really understanding all of the complications of the different classifications and all. And I've called on Michael for help identifying plants, which would help me understand better what to expect. And I think the other way has worked as well. And we've had a couple of nice interactions over the years, just like that.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page, and we're already getting quite a few. Obviously, people are preparing for that little hike in the woods. My guests are Dr. Michael J. Balick, Vice President for Botanical Science and Director and Phylicology Curator at the New York Botanical Garden Institute of Economic Botany, and Dr. Lewis Nelson, an associate professor of emergency medicine at New York University School of Medicine, an attending physician at both NYU Medical Center and Bellevue Hospital, both of them authors of The Handbook of Poisonous and Injurious Plants. We'll be back right after this. You can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Tilda Swinton and Pat Benatar. Just go to our show page and click where it says View Photos of Recent Guests. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. And we're back with today's Please Explain look at poisonous and injurious plants with Dr. Lewis Nelson and Dr. Michael J. Balick. Have I been mispronouncing your name, Dr. Balick?
No, not at all.
Oh, I thought I was. Is it Balick or Balick then?
Balick.
Okay. Well, we are taking calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And I'll go to one of those comments first. Connie in New Jersey says, I never got a poison ivy reaction until this year when suddenly I'm getting it like crazy. At least my dermatologist says that's what it looks like. What could make me sensitive from one year to the next? And she ends by saying she's 52 years old.
Well, more than likely, the previous exposures were either washed off quickly or were below a dose that actually induced any sort of immune sensitization. And that or perhaps a change in her immune system allowed her to become more sensitized to it. But that does happen. And some people will live long parts of their life without ever having poison ivy, and then it just develops. And I'm not sure there's a better answer than that.
Mary Royce in Clifton says poison ivy that grows near the beach areas produces a white berry, which migrating birds feed on. They don't seem to be bothered by the poison.
Well, I guess that answers the earlier question. You know, clearly there's difference in species and the way they respond to chemicals. I mean, we know, for example, in our own world with animals, with pets, that we love chocolate. We don't have a problem with chocolate. Mm. We know that dogs don't eat chocolate and do well. I mean, they develop severe hyperactivity, a lot of vomiting and diarrhea. They can seize. They can have problems with it, particularly dark chocolate. Yet, we eat it and we feel quite nice afterwards.
Let's go to our callers. First, Tom from Plainfield, New Jersey. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
How are you? Thanks. I've got a question. I try to do things without drugs and all that kind of stuff, and I've read on some of those poison ivy sites that you can build an immunity if in the early part of the season you take the smallest leaves and you eat one a day. You swallow it. You try not to get it, too much in the front of your mouth. Or as I tried is I put it in like those little gelatin gel caps. Is this true? I tried it, and they say you do it for a month, and then you have immunity for like a couple of years. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, okay, I don't want to give out specific medical advice about how to desensitize yourself, but one of my favorite cases that Michael and I ever worked on, where I got a call from Michael saying there's a couple of Japanese artists who just showed up at the botanical gardens, and they're asking to see our poison ivy collection. And he's like, why would they do that? And it turns out, and this is probably a little-known fact, that Japanese lacquerware, going back for centuries, has been made using the lacquer, the toxin that comes out of the Japanese lacquer tree. Now, it turns out that toxin, that chemical that they use to make the lacquer on top of these wooden structures, is the same compound, urushiol, that you find in poison ivy. So what these people were doing were coming to the United States and seeking an easy form of urushiol, of the poison ivy toxin, in order to maintain their immune desensitization, which they need, because when they go back to work, had the desensitization worn off, they'd have to go through a period of re-desensitization again to get exactly the effects that you're looking for.
Now, Sophie from Long Island points out that homeopathic medicines for joint pains often use poisonous plants in very small quantities.
I think the quantities are undetectable, and I think that's the answer.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, anyway, thank you so much for your call, Tom. And we go now to Janet from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a home-based problem, or if it is a problem. I have a plant called Indian rope plant. I think it's a type of Hoya. And during the summer, I have it for many years, it gets a blossom. It's like a blossom made of little flowers, little pink flowers, and it gives off what I consider a toxic stench. And as soon as the flowers arrive, I can smell it. And I'm wondering if you know anything about this.
Well, the fragrances that plants give off are primarily to attract pollinators. Pollinators can be insects or birds or other organisms, and perhaps this is the Hoya's way of saying I'm ready. Mm. But I've never heard of that fragrance being toxic to humans.
There would be very few toxins that would be, you know, propagated through the air that way.
Bill from Westchester, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, guys. A two-part question. I cut my lawn, and I get poison ivy on my boots. I was surprised at the longevity of the oils. Is there a period where you can say, okay, it's been a week, your boots are safe? I know I'm talking roughly. And also, is there any natural concoctions you can spray on poison ivy to kill it?
Well, you know, the concept of this lacquer is that I referred to before is that when they paint it onto the wood, over a period of time it hardens, and once it's hard, you don't get poison ivy by touching anymore. So this urushiol, this toxin, is basically polymerized into a very solid sheen. Now, I don't really know how long that takes. I imagine it's probably going to be measured in terms of days or weeks, not in terms of minutes or hours. I think the best thing to do would be to wash your hands and your shoes thoroughly using a soap to get rid of the toxin. It's an oily resin, and it's relatively easy to clean up. In terms of ways to kill the plants, I don't think there's anything specific. I mean, maybe Michael knows, but other than an herbicide that you would use to kill most garden, you know, garden weeds.
We've gotten a comment from a listener who says that, Winsome from New York, says that he started exterminating poison ivy from his farm, and one folk remedy is putting jewel weed on the poison ivy. Have you ever heard that?
Well, I think jewel weed is really to treat the blisters from poison ivy. Jewel weed has a very thick stem full of sap, and what I learned as a young kid walking through the forest is if we brushed against poison ivy, jewel weed often grows right around the poison ivy. You crush the stem and immediately put it on your the area that you've touched the poison ivy. But it will not kill poison ivy in your yard. I think you need to go to a garden center and ask them for some specific remedies. I'd also suggest that Dr. Nelson was talking about when you burn poison ivy, the smoke can get in your lungs. It can also get in your clothes and things like that, and it never – you can dry clean the clothes several times, and you won't get it out. So you really have to work on your boots or be careful.
Jack from Westchester has a suggestion. Hi, Jack.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I had picked up some folk wisdom, I guess it is, some years ago, that told me that the antidote – to a poisonous plant often grows nearby, and this might have some relation to the jewel weed, of which I'm not familiar, but I was told that mugwort often grows near poison ivy, and that's an antidote. Is this, in fact, true, or is it folklore that it's still often poisonous plants.
Well, there's a wide variety of folklore about all sorts of things. I'm not familiar with that particular species, so I can't say.
Let me go through some of the comments that we've been receiving on our show page. Laura asks if poison oak and poison sumac can be found in this part of the country. Is it mostly just poison ivy?
Michael?
We can find poison oak, I believe, in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but primarily poison ivy.
Yep, I think poison ivy grows around the country. The toxin in the three of those plants is essentially identical. Although, obviously, the forms of the plants are quite different.
So it's just a matter of knowing how to identify each, but in the end, the treatment would be pretty much the same. Wash it as quickly as possible and wait for it to go away?
I think that, right, the treatment would really be preventing the toxin from sitting too long on your skin to initiate its immune response. Once you have the blisters, it's just a matter of giving it time. You know, one thing I would remind people is that, especially if you touch it more, with intent. In other words, if it just brushes by you, it's one thing. But if you pick it up with your hand or something, often this resin winds up under your fingernails and in other places. And everywhere you scratch on your body or touch on your body, you're going to wind up depositing some of that toxin. So you wind up getting poison ivy in places that you wouldn't otherwise expect to get it. So all of the body has to be washed, and the fingernails really have to be cleaned as well.
George in Manhattan says, I'm one of those people who isn't sensitive. I've been told it's because I'm an asthma sufferer. Is that possible?
You know, I don't know that. I mean, I could probably make up a reason, but I don't think I've ever heard that. You know, nobody really knows, but it's said about 70% or 80% of the population could be sensitized. Remember, there is a certain dose phenomenon. So, one tiny speck of it versus, getting a handful of it might make the difference as well. And I think, though, as toxins, sensitizers go, this is certainly considered to be among the most potent.
Another listener asks if different races and ethnicities have different levels of sensitivity.
You know, I don't know that. I don't know that.
I would imagine that with different amounts of our skins are different. They have different. There are racial differences to some degree, as far as oil is concerned, as far as melanin is concerned. Probably would affect it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that the melanin really have much of an effect, because this is, the immune capabilities of our skin are really, I think, quite similar, and I'm really stretching here. I really don't think there'd be a tremendous difference among the races.
EJ from Chelsea read in Scientific American that humans are the only animals sensitive to poison ivy, that rabbits eat it. There's no vaccine because we can't test it on humans.
I don't know that either. If that's a fact, I believe it. I mean, clearly there's species differences in the toxicity. I don't really practice that kind of medicine, but it seems reasonable.
And Adam from Manhattan says, I've heard that you could rent goats that eat poison ivy and it has no effect on them. So I guess if you have a farm and you want to get rid of the poison ivy, the poison ivy, you say, is a weed?
It's a very aggressive, invasive species. People talk about the fact that they're seeing more and more poison ivy, and mostly it's due to our clearing of woodsy areas and wilderness areas to build homes and other things, to clear land. And this plant comes in and just is very happy invading habitat.
Regarding another plant, a listener asks if TCH, which is in marijuana, is a poison.
Well, it's THC.
THC.
Well,
it shows you how sophisticated I am, but that's what they wrote.
Well, that's okay. This brings up a really great point, which is the difference between a poison and a medication and a whatever, which in general, a lot of this is a social construct, and a lot of it is a dose effect. Many of the medications that we currently use were derived from plants to begin with. Some of them, in fact, are still derived directly from plants. You know, digoxin and atropine. These are complicated molecules that we can't even synthesize. We take them directly out of plants. A chemical like THC is very complex, and it is generally derived from a plant as well. Now, the way it's used is in a social setting that's considered to be beneficial, and it's even used medicinally for people with, you know, cancer and other chronic pain syndromes. So in that setting, you would call it, you know, a drug or a medication, depending on what you were using it for. However, given it enough of a dose, I mean, you can suffer severely from THC. You can, people get, some mental status changes. They can have cardiac arrhythmias and other problems in a high enough dose. So depending on the dose that you've used and the setting you've used it in, you really change something from a medicine to a poison, and from something that's therapeutic and beneficial to something that's dangerous.
Let's take another call. Pam from Middletown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I worked for many years on Sandy Hook, and one of the benefits we saw of poison ivy, which is everywhere, is that it was a great holder of the dunes, the back dunes. It had very deep root systems, and it helped to hold the sand. And, of course, it kept people also off the dunes, which was very beneficial in many cases so that the beach would remain where it is. So, anyway, that was a couple of the things that we used to think was good, though, of course, we made sure that the kids and nobody went into the poison ivy. So,
of course, there are other plants that could also hold those dunes together, and they won't function as irritants.
Although, you know, there is this famous expression that goes something like a rose growing in a wheat field would be considered a weed.
Yeah.
You know, and really a weed is, again, it's really a social concept. You know, it's something that's good in the right setting and bad in the right setting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Edward, hi, you're on the air. Edward from Middletown.
Yes, hello. Nice to get to call you all. I'm just wondering whether when I hit a golf ball into the brush or, the, you know, the area where there's vegetation, and I go in and get that ball, would I be contacting poison ivy because of picking up a golf ball in the wrong area?
Well, it depends if the poison ivy is in the spot where you hit the ball. So I think the lesson is that you should familiarize yourself with what poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac, all which grow in the Northeast, what they look like. And you can get pictures off the web or in the book that was mentioned.
And if the ball has fallen within a patch, avoid it or put on a glove, I guess?
Well, remember the clothes will get oily.
So mm-hmm. You got to be careful handling that glove as well.
I just leave it there and walk away from it.
Well,
that
yeah.
sounds like a good decision.
It's better than having to go to a doctor with a serious case of poison ivy. I'm assuming that we can get pictures of those plants in books, but also just by going to the internet.
Sure, sure.
And if people just want to know right now how they might easily identify them, poison ivy, is there something that we can tell them to avoid?
I think it would be best to look at a photograph. Plants, to some people, start looking similar, and if I were to give you a botanical description or even a general description of the three leaves, glossy on the upper side, lesser so on the underside, by the time you've examined the underside, I think you're in trouble.
Are there any plants? We have just a few seconds. Are there any plants that actually will kill us?
There are many plants that would kill you. It becomes a matter of how the toxin from the plant gets into your body.
Uh-huh. Eating is probably the
best. There are probably very
way.
Few that you'd brush up against picking up a golf ball that would kill you. Probably none.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, both of you, Dr. Lewis Nelson, Dr. Michael J. Balick, co-authors of Handbook of Poisonous and Injurious Plants. It's been really fascinating. On Monday's show, we'll look into why fewer works of literature are being translated into English, and we'll find out what kinds of challenges translators face. Then jazz singer Jane Monheit Also, artist Art Spiegelman and musician Dan Zanes discuss collaborating with the Palabolas Dance Company and will be joined by Pills Michael Tracy, one of the company's members. Plus, we'll learn about how playgrounds have been changing, along with our notions of how children play. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Eakin is the executive producer, and we had help today from Matt Joseloff, Matt Gurry, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you at noon on Monday.